0818 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon. You are very welcome to Liveline. Katie Hannon back with you this week until 3 o'clock. Last week we had a big chat about RIP.ie being sold, and that kicked off conversations around why we are so obsessed, in one way you could say, but so interested in death and the rituals around death, and when we feel they're so important. 60 million hits a month on that website gives you some indication of it. But in the course of that, listeners got in touch with us and told us about this festival about death, called The Keening. This is celebrating an Irish wake, so we wanted to find out a bit more about this. Kevin Toulis, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Yeah, Kevin, this is your baby, if I can say it that way. Tell us, what is The Keening about?
Well, The Keening is the world's first festival dedicated to the ancient arts of the Irish wake. And it's rather amazing that we're having it in Mayo and part of the Home to Mayo festivities. But we're celebrating something that is a rite that's 15,000 years old, that is so central to Irish culture. It completely distinguishes Ireland from most of the rest of Europe. It's something, a kind of iconic cultural treasure, and something that the festival is actually trying to highlight, celebrate, and also sort of protect against the encroachment of what you might call the Anglo-Saxon way of death, where funerals become, you know, very private affairs, hardly anyone ever goes, and we kind of ignore death. So that's what the festival is about, celebrating the Irish wake.
I do think a lot of us here look kind of askance at the traditions, or the lack of traditions, I suppose, around English deaths and the fact that somebody isn't buried for maybe weeks at a time. But I think that's more a logistics thing probably than a traditional issue. You're British, Scottish, but your people are Irish, are they? Are you totally Irish?
I'm Irish. I'm told them both my parents are Achill Islanders. The main thing is I grew up a very strong Irish tradition. I went to my first wake when I was 7. With my mother here on the island, Balnasolly. And part of the whole strength of the Irish wake is my mother was teaching me, even at that age, how to kind of live with death. I remember I was too small to actually look in the coffin. She had to pull me up. And then she told me, touch him. And, you know, obviously I knew, even as a 7-year-old, that this person, this old man in the coffin wasn't a statue. There was something strange about it. But my mother said to me, touch them, it'll make you less afraid. And obviously it's that touch of the dead, you know, they're so cold. But it's part of normalising death. It is so important as a means and a mechanism by how we teach our children how to die, how to go on living, how we educate ourselves too about how normal death is. Even the worst of deaths, even the worst of tragedies, that's part of human nature. And that's why it's so important that we cherish this rite.
I think, like yourself, I remember the first time. It was my granddad, and I would have been about 4, maybe, and that I saw a dead person. And it is seared into my memory because it was like a moment in time. But as you say, then you go on, and of course, as an Irish person, you see multiple scores of dead people throughout your lifetime. That's not something, you know, our cousins in the UK would have.
No, I mean, and one of the interesting things that we're highlighting in the Keening Festival, so it's on May the 18th in Mulranny, Mulranny Arts Centre down in here in Mayo, but the different regional traditions, like there's a thing in Mayo, yeah, when you take the body out of the house for the last time, you actually take the coffin and you put it on 2 chairs in the front garden, and then people splash holy water on top of the coffin against the side of the house. They say a few more prayers as well. But really, what they're doing is it's a kind of, an anthropologist would call it a rite of reversal. They're creating a supernatural barrier between the spirit of the dead person and the remaining living in the house, that the spirit of the dead won't come back to kind of haunt you. You're investing in laying the dead to rest with the proper funeral rites so that, in a sense, the world can begin again and everything's normal.
Is there something, you know, the practice of covering the mirrors, is that a West of Ireland thing, or is that part of this idea of not, you know, the spirits being let go?
I suppose it's, you know, it's up for your for listeners to come in with their own particular regional tradition. But obviously, one of the ways is there's a lot of, you know, obviously rites and superstitions around death and dying and covering the mirrors, stopping the clocks. There's even some bardic poetry, you know, where we talk about, you know, our prayers for the dead. You know, back, it's sort of like your grandmother, you know, they laid you out on the kitchen table and stopped the clocks, though no one knew the reason why. Mary Lynch, that was her name, my first corpse. Knocked down by a streetcar on West 25th Street. The poor thing, you could see the bruise. She was 11 and I was 10. So all that whole experience and all that culture and tradition, it's so wrapped around the central core of Irish culture. It's amazing that the Keening is the first festival ever in 15,000 years to celebrate the Irish Wake.
Honestly, as you say it, it is. I'm just thinking exactly the same thing. Why did it take us so long to try and capture all of this in a festival? But I suppose, is there a bit of a feeling that we shouldn't be? It shouldn't be kind of in a festival space, that it should be something that's, you know, preserved for the dead?
Well, I mean, there are lots of ancient arts in the Irish Wake. There's riddles, there was singing, there's telling stories, there's bardic poetry. And why shouldn't we sort of celebrate those arts? And why shouldn't we sort of remember them, cherish them? I mean, I'm old enough to have played a wake game when I was 15 as a teenager here in Achill. And then we went to the dance, and then someone said, should we go to the wake for the crack? And we piled in as teenagers into this wake. It was an old person that died. Wasn't particularly tragic. And we played an old Irish wake game called the button. I'm sure many of your listeners will have played wake games in their own time. And that was really, it's a bit of sort of like slightly mocking the dead. It was like a dating game, but it was a lesson at teaching young people really to say, well, death is going to come, so you might as well seize life. When we played the button, somebody hit a button, you had to guess who it was. And if you didn't guess the right person, then you kind of paid a forfeit. And if you were a boy, the Burrakeen, the jester who was running the show, he hit you very hard on his hand. And if you're a girl, you often had to go outside with a boy chosen by the Burrakeen. So there's a bit of dating, teenage, you know, sniggering, going on. All of this is taking place within 10 feet of the corpse, you know. So you can say, my God, how shocking. But you can also say, well, isn't that really wonderful? Because you're teaching these young people to say, life goes on, seize the moment. You know, enjoy life.
I know you say that this significance of the wake that goes all the way back to the Iliad.
It does. It's in the last line of the Iliad in ancient Greek, is hos hoigan tapan hektoros hippodamoio. Thus held they wake and funeral for Hector, tamer of horses. And Homer, who wrote the Iliad in 750 BC, there's another line where the Trojan king is told that if he goes into the Greek camp, he can get his dead son Hector away from the enemy Achilles. And his wife says, you know, don't go there. Don't go into the Greek camp because they'll surely kill you. And then King Priam says something totally wonderful. He said, I don't care if the Greeks kill me, just as long as I have the heart-comforting embrace of my dead son in my arms. I mean, that was written nearly 3,000 years ago. And it's all about this sort of compassion for the dead, paying them proper respect, laying them to rest, and then moving on with the rest of our lives. And it's a real central core message in the Iliad, and it's a central core message in the Irish Wake.
And, you know, I'm thinking of poetry myself and Seamus Heaney, that midterm break is just...
For sure.
I mean, I think there's that line, a foot for every year.
Yeah,
it's for anyone who has been close to that. It's just one of those lines in a poem that will stop everyone in their tracks. And the W.H. Auden, of course, that everyone will know, even if they don't know anything about W.H. Auden, if they watch Four Weddings and a Funeral, the "Stop All the Clocks" line. So much of our poetry is tied in to these moments.
Yeah, well, the most important thing also about the wake is that people turn up. You know, you turn up in great numbers. There's another poem that we have in the show called "If I Could Sing." If you could hear my song, you too would listen in rapture to the Imra Kinsha, crying out keening, heart struck still for Hector and his children, sundered in the same grieving, that the living and the dead must commingle in the sickening and the dying and the grave. Ancient and new, an eternal chorus, mourners, keeners, pilgrims at the wake, bound to ensure belief that in this unselfish giving to the dead, that newborn sons and daughters will spring from the pulsating wombs of the lamenting living. And one of the core aspects of the wake, and this might sound strange, is of course it is actually a fertility rite. It is about replacing the dead person. That's why women play such a central role in the wake, is because from these women, the community will go on. You know, that we are eternal in a sense of a community, even though that we've lost this individual.
The role of women in particular, and again, this is something that I think really is dying out. I mean, to some degree, oh God, I should be saying dying out. I shouldn't be using punning in that way. But the idea of keeners, because I think the wake, I honestly think, and I even think in Dublin, there has been a bit of a revival of the wake. And I think Joe, who spoke to us on the show on Friday, was saying that there was a sense of people wanting to be waked at home and wanting to wake their loved ones at home. But this idea of keening that is just, you know, from the very traditional old Irish wake, particularly West of Ireland wake, that I think is almost gone, is it?
Well, some aspects of Irish society still do. I know that the travelling community have a very strong, you know, keening tradition. I know on the West Coast, you know, you wouldn't have sort of formal keening employer keeners. But I remember my own father, Sonny, when he died here, there was quite a bit of keening in that room when my aunts first came in to see him. And the idea of keening really is to sort of enhance the emotional level. I mean, it goes, the ancient Greeks did it, the Romans did it, they still do it in communities all around the world too. And sometimes they hire professional keeners. I mean, it may sound strange to us, but if you hire a professional undertaker, you don't expect him to cry, you know, personally. Yes. So keeners are there, in a sense, to sort of show respect for the dead and to kind of incite the mourners for this catharsis of grief. And that's what it's about, is that you show this public emotion, and that's a good thing.
Do we have a clip of it? I'll just play very briefly. This is keener Breedney Voynig. Let's have a quick listen if we can.
Oh, no, get off, no,
the words we always associated with Peg. It would definitely bring you to that place, for sure, Kevin. Kevin, will you hang on? I've got Mildred. Oh, Mildred. Good afternoon, Mildred.
Good afternoon, Katie. I was waiting for you to break into song that time.
I don't know, would my keening be quite up to scratch now, Mildred?
Wouldn't be too bad.
But listen, you're over there in Mayo as well. You must have gone to a fair few wakes in your time.
Well, I sure did. At the minute, I live in Loch Inn, but I came originally from Mayo. And yes, I saw wakes many, many, many times. And my grandmother, yes, I saw a wake, and my father, and then later on my own husband. And the wake is, I think it should be kept and it should be respected. And please don't let it go, because it helps the family of the deceased person to at least come to terms with it. You won't get over it in a couple of days, but it'll help you to to get over the sadness and bring you through them couple of days. I mean, when my husband died on the Friday, and he was in the house, waked in the house until Sunday morning till we took him to Mass. But, like, it's the loveliest tradition you could have for the family and the neighbours. And the neighbours, come in and they do their thing and they bring their different bits and pieces. And, of course, years and years and years and years ago, they would have the clay pipes to give around and the cigarettes at the wake.
And the snow.
Mind you, they'd have a dropping of the crater as well, but they used to have the clay pipes.
And
whether you smoked or not, you took the pipe and you smoked, or whether you smoked, you could take the cigarette and smoke. It was a lovely thing, and I'd be ashamed to let it die. I know there's some houses that can't wake their family in the house and all that, and that's where the funeral homes came in and all that sort of thing. But if you can, it helps you to get over it. It helps you to live with the fact that you have lost the person.
I think you hear the best stories, don't you? You hear the stories, sides of the person who's gone that you never heard before.
Of course you do. And because the person is deceased, there's stories that people don't mind telling now that he or she is deceased, you see. So you hear that. And, you know, Katie, because I'm involved in the music thing, in Ballintubber here in County Roscommon, they bring home like about 80 American students to do an archaeology dig. And then while they're there, we entertain them for the month that they're here. And we put on an American wake for them. Now, an American wake is depicted a wake, but in this case, it's where people left to go to America. And, of course, they would never come home again. So we did the American wake just exactly the same as there was a person deceased, because they were going to America the next day and there'd be no back. So we did the wake and we done exactly the same as we would do as if there was a deceased person, and the people would stay up all night and then they'd go off then to the train in the morning, and the mum and dad would be out at the door crying and all that sort of thing. And it was, so we depicted that for the American students, and they could not believe that happened in Ireland.
Oh, yeah.
They loved it.
And it happened over and over and over again.
Yes, Katie.
And going back
with
to your own
families.
Going back to your own situation there, Mildred, your husband.
Yeah.
That's a while ago now, is it?
Yeah, 38 years tomorrow. Oh. He died.
So tomorrow is
tomorrow.
Tomorrow is his anniversary. And they got that. So was there a big age gap there, Mildred, then?
Well, there was, yeah. My late husband was much older than I was, but it never interfered with our life, you know. We were in the music business. We didn't have time to think how old he is or how young I am or anything like that. So it never kind of interfered with us at all.
When he did go, just the planning of a week, like the sandwich making and the buying in of the porter and the buying in of the... Can you remember any of that now going back?
Well, you mean when my husband died?
When you had to do your... Yeah, that way.
Well, no. The neighbours done it, Katie. The neighbours done it. Your house, you have enough to cope with because the person has died. But the neighbours come in and they simply take over. They take over, and that's the one. I was lucky in the sense that I had great neighbours, and of course I was living beside the convent, and the nuns were down in and out and up and down, so it was like a convent here for me, and I was like above in their convent. It was lovely to have the neighbours, but the family doesn't have to do much, only look at the person has died, this is it, and they all come in. And they bring whatever they bring, and they do whatever has to be done. And the loveliness of even the Gaird, even the Gaird on duty, we were going down the avenue bringing the remains to the church. And the sergeant at the time, Sergeant Lynn, was at the end of the avenue. And, you know, as the remains was coming, he saluted. I'll never forget that. Never forget that.
Oh, Mildred, you even 38 years later.
Yeah. But you see, it's it's what the neighbours do that you never, ever, ever forget. And that's why the week should never be let die. Ever. I'm sorry for saying let die, but do you know what I mean?
I know what you mean, Mildred. Yeah, it shouldn't let be drift away. That people, the value of it is something you can't actually calculate.
It helps you. It helps you get over. And you're, I mean, 38 years on, I'm still remembering. And you remember the people that came. And you remember the people that didn't come.
I was going to say, you'll always remember the ones who didn't turn up either. That is definitely part of the Irish wake and the post-mortem afterwards.
Yes. And then the mass. I was at a mass yesterday over in Tomacade. And that's very much, very much Mayo. Very deep in the heart of Mayo. And that mass was full of music because the man was great into set dancing. And that mass is full of music and full of singing. And I think if we stay there yet, the priest would have said, get on with it, which was lovely.
It's a lovely, lovely, it's a lovely thing. Mildred, hang on. I've got Bernie. Bernie Ní Laoghaire. How are you?
How are you, Katie?
I'm very well, Bernie. You were thinking back to your own situation and wishing you had what Mildred has. These memories.
That's making me sadder listening to Imelda talking about the neighbours because my mother died during COVID restrictions 3 years ago, in March. And the neighbours didn't get the chance. Now, some people did leave in literally food at the doorstep, but they did not get the chance to. We all didn't get the chance to have that lovely chats and the talk about my mother. In the kitchen, the way, and that is part. And we didn't realise at the time we were just going through the motions of the sudden death and the grieving. And and then only 10 people in a very empty church. It's, but it was fantastic to come out and see the car park full of people standing within 2 metres of one another. And that gave us great comfort. And at same at the graveside, some people did come to the graveside and again stood away. But it was just looking back on it now, it was, I think we were robbed of some of that grieving process.
Yeah, because we did talk a lot at the time about how people couldn't have the funeral services or the funeral masses. But actually, when you think about it, it is the wakes that were the big, big loss for people.
Yes. Correct.
For everyone. I mean, I know it's, as Mildred was saying there, it's so important for the family and it gives you such comfort over those days and you get this wall of love and care from your neighbours. But I think for the neighbours and the friends and all the people, because obviously it's not just the family who are grieving.
No. And also for 9 of us, there's me and 8 siblings and we all have friends who are scattered all over Ireland. So there were travel restrictions as well. So they couldn't travel. So you missed out on a lot of that stuff. And as you said, the stories, like there'd be relations in other parts of Connemara who wouldn't have been able to come over. We could have heard stories. There might have been stories there that we hadn't heard and will never hear now. Because you know how you mean to go and visit somebody later to console them or, for condolences. You kind of never do. The way you mean, if you miss a funeral and you say, I'll visit that house now in a few weeks, and then a few weeks go, and then you think it's too late.
Life intervenes, exactly, yeah.
So, there was, but look, it's not the end of the world, but to us, it's only now, actually, that I'm looking back and thinking about it, that we were robbed of that great tradition of wakes, and long may they live.
Yeah, absolutely. There's no doubt about it. It's something that's very, very special, and it's, as you say, you get memories and stories and you get reminded of the person's place in everyone's world that
and also people coming in for those few days distract the... siblings together for 2 or 3 days can be quite intense, Katie. It would have been very welcome to have, the odd distraction or the odd neighbour that you mightn't have wanted to see, but it'd be great to, it all adds to the occasion, because it is an occasion, it is. It's the end of somebody's life. It's the celebration of somebody's life.
It is. It is for sure. I was just, and we'll hopefully be talking about it. I know people want to talk about that great movie, the great film That They May Face the Rising Sun. And of course, at the centre of that, without giving away any spoilers, there is an unexpected death and a wake and a funeral in the middle of, a wake at least, in the middle of that. And again, it really just brought you back to those wakes, you know, of your childhood. And
I believe that it was filmed in Loch Na Fui, which is here in Cremara, and I believe the scenery is stunning. And it is beautiful back there.
It is absolutely stunning. I can't say enough about how beautiful it was, and it is.
Well, that's where it was, Loch Na Fui, some of the filming made in Loch Na Fui.
Absolutely, yeah. We'll definitely. If you're 51551, if anyone else has seen that movie, we'll hopefully get to it shortly. But I want to stay with this now because people really feel so strongly about how important this is to us, that the Irish Wake. Sandra, good afternoon.
Hi, Katie. How are you? I tell you, I'm just thinking. I would hate the idea of the wake just going out. Because I know it's associated a lot with country people, but I'm born and bred in Dublin. But we've always had, funny, on my mum's side of the family, we've always had wakes. But on my dad's side, they didn't. But I would hate the tradition. I've asked my family to do, you know, to wake me, come to bring me home. But the last time my dad, I think the first time I was only 8, when my great-grandmother, and at that time, they weren't laid out. It wasn't the coffin. She was actually laid out in the bed in my grandmother's house. And I think I was only about 8, because then my grandmother died only young. She only died a few years later. I was 12 when she died. And I was asked, now, to be fair, if I wanted to. Like, if I didn't want to, that was okay, or to see her. And then the last one was my dad, and my brother died tragically, and that was 93, and we waked him, we brought him home. And actually, when I think of it, we've often remarked, he had a dog, and would you believe the dog sat at the end of the coffin for the whole time that my brother was there. And the dog actually passed away not long after my brother. And we've often remarked about that. But my dad died in 2009. And again, thankfully, he actually died at home in my house. We were hoping he would, and they thought he'd have to be in hospital, but thankfully he didn't. So he died in my house, and then we brought him back home to my house. And it's like you were saying, like, it sounds very strange, but it wasn't all sad. You know, and we took turns. You made a reference, I think, earlier on or in the promo about taking turns, which is exactly what we did. We're only a small family. And we took turns through the night. Two people sat with him
to sit
at each time for every couple of hours, you know.
The tradition being you never leave the body.
Yes, exactly. And we just took turns sitting with him. And even his brothers, you know, they were telling us old stories about when he was young and what he got up to and what he didn't get up to. And we actually had a laugh. Now, I know that sounds very strange, but, you know, we actually had fun about the story, telling stories about him, and even almost talking to him as he was there, saying, oh, yeah, we remember what you were up to, you know, and that kind of thing. And my granddaughter, who was only 2 at the time, and we let her kind of go around, and she was, you know, the handles on the side of the coffin, and she was kind of kept going to play with them. And my daughter was saying, no, we can't talk. And I said, no, leave her. You know, leave her alone, let her, you know, feel whatever. But again, just the sitting, telling stories, like you said, neighbours dropping in sandwiches and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And it was actually beautiful. And I'd hate to think the tradition would die out. I'm sorry again for the pun. And I've said it to my daughters, and I hope they will continue it on.
So have they promised you, Sandra, that they will wake you when the time comes?
Yes, because I did say to them, you know, I don't want them to be uncomfortable either, so I've asked them, would they feel okay about doing it? And they said, yes, no problem. Okay. So I've already said, yes, I would love it. I think it's a beautiful, beautiful tradition, and it would be very, very sad if it faded out.
Can I say, Sandra, wholeheartedly agree.
Kevin, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, Yeah, of course, because that's basically what the Keening, the festival, is about. And also, I did actually write a book called My Father's Wake, How the Irish Teach Us to Live, Love and Die, precisely because these things can kind of disappear from under you without anyone saying. It's a bit like Keening. You know, Keening has kind of disappeared, and then we never remarked upon it, and then it's gone. So it's the same thing with the wake. And I wrote a book about my own father's very traditional wake on Achill Island, despite the fact that I'd seen a lot of death and all over the world. But there was something both therapeutic and healing about precisely what you're saying, the community coming together, people telling stories. One of the things that we have in the festival is we have, we call it the Sorrows of the Killeen, which is those graveyards, you know, for unbaptized children, where the Catholic Church, you know, refused to allow stillborn children to be buried in consecrated ground. And it was during the wake that one of my neighbours told me, you know, that she had buried a child there. I mean, this woman was in her 80s. She buried a child in the Killeen, which is just about 300 yards from where I'm speaking now. It's just on the edge of the village. And there was something about the moments of, like, I don't know, the special, it's a, they call it a liminal zone between life and death. When people reveal themselves and they tell stories, you know, they tell stories about life and death, sometimes the most precious things that have happened to them, sometimes the scariest things have happened to them too. But there's that moment, you know, I don't know, about 3 o'clock, you need to kind of keep yourself entertained, keep yourself awake during those long hours.
Yes.
And so it's a very special time, really. I remember writing in the book, I probably never do anything more important in my life than the days that I spent waking my father, Sonny, here in Achill Island.
Well, it's actually been very interesting reading that book, actually, by the sounds of it. Yeah, it's, and actually, it's funny you mentioned that.
My father's wake is easy to remember.
Yeah, I was just going to say that. I won't forget the name of it anyway. But it's funny now that you mentioned about the baby. I actually did. I had lost a baby. She only lived for a few minutes and she passed away. But I also brought her home. And believe it or not, I know it sounds strange, but waked her. Even though, you know,
that's the right thing to do.
Yeah, and I didn't put her in a coffin. I put her in a little basket with all, you know, little things around her. And my two daughters, there was a big gap. There was a 12-year gap. And they put little toys in with her and they wrote a letter for her. And they put the things in with her that they wanted. And, you know, it was just, again, it sounds strange, but it was lovely.
And Sandra, can I ask you, has that made... I'm sure that was really, really important for your daughters at the time to be part of that, because I think...
Well, you know, that's exactly it, Katie. Because they were, as I said, my youngest daughter at that time, as I said, was 12. And again, it might sound strange, but I actually have pictures. They held her, you know, they both held her and I took pictures of them. And we still to this day, I mean, she would have been, we put balloons actually up in the air last year. She would have been 21. So for her 21st birthday, we still, you know, we got a load of pink and white balloons and we got together in the house and we just, I won't say celebrated, but acknowledged, if you like, her 21st birthday. And again,
that's lovely. That's so lovely, Sandra.
And yeah, they still say, like, even when we're talking as a family, they just say about their sister. Yeah, and if they're talking to anybody, they say, yeah, their sister that died, even though they never got to know her. But you're right, it was very important for them at that age. And as I said before, and then I coffined her myself. As I said, I had her in a basket. It sounds strange. If you remember the basket, you used to get like a big Easter egg in with the handle. And I put a lovely pink, a blanket underneath her. And had, as I said, little toys and that. And as you said, they were part of it, you know. And as I said, they wrote their little letters. And one of my daughters had a little glowworm at the time, which she adored. And she put that in the coffin with her. Or, sorry, put it on the basket. And then I coffined her myself the next day, got her ready. And we did,
Sandra,
have a little funeral.
That must be, I mean, it must have been, I mean, it was lovely. And it sounds so... lovely that you were able to, you know, make that such a normal family and a family event for your daughters. But it must have been very difficult.
It was, to be honest, it was. And I think sometimes, I don't know, I think you could kind of go on auto. You know, I remember the family saying, you know, keep an eye on Sandra. She's not doing, you know, she's very, but it wasn't. It was because I was able to do that. And I remember my mother-in-law at the time saying to me, she had lost a baby years and years ago, but she didn't even see the baby. You know, she said the baby was taken away. And how she was saying how times had changed. And whereas we did have the option of bringing her home and being, as I said, it was only immediate family, obviously, with the being the baby. But it was very hard. And I have to say the hardest part, I think like any death or wake, was putting the lid on the coffin.
Always, yeah. Always.
Yeah. You know, because up to then, she's still there. She's still part of us. You know, we were still. But, you know, once I put her in and fixed her and all that and put our little letters and things on a family picture, we put actually a family picture in with her. And, yeah, the hardest part was, putting the lid on the coffin. And but what we had to do was, I was actually quite obsessed. There wasn't a priest available, believe it or not, in the hospital at the time to bless her. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not over-religious or anything, but I did want her blessed. So the priest was beautiful. It was at, you know, the small church in the Pro Cathedral? Yeah. There's a little church at the back, and that's where we had the little funeral. So we actually took the lid off the coffin so that the priest could bless her. And then my two daughters, actually, we let them pick her name. And they both want a different name, so we gave her a double-barreled name. So they were so much part of it. And then I was felt, okay, once she was blessed. And we did have a little funeral, like, not just the immediate family.
Yeah.
And
What did you name her, Sandra?
Andrea Patrice.
Oh.
Andrea
because,
Patrice.
Yeah, one your daughter son. Wanted Andrea and the other daughter wanted Patrice because it was the day after St. Patrick's Day, the 18th, when she died. And, yeah, so they loved that even to this day, you know, that they picked her name.
Yeah.
And it was just, and the fact then that we had her blessed, and when we got out, I just had her on my lap in the car, and the coffin, obviously, on the way out. And I remember when we got out of the car, my husband got out first and he went around and I handed the coffin to him and he was going to hand it, I thought, to the gravedigger, and which I thought at the time, in fairness, it was very touchy of him. He said, no, you brought her into the world, so you can give her back out. So I just handed her over. My brother, as I said, had already died. So I put her on his left hand. They were lovely even in the graveyard. They asked me what side did I want her on. And I'd already bought my grave beside my brother. And he was left-handed. I know this all sounds very, very strange, but I put her in beside him on his left side.
And you felt he was minding. He was minding.
That's exactly it. I said his arm would be around her now.
Oh, that's
beautiful. And he'll mind her up there until I go up to join them. And I know it might sound very strange, but again, it was beautiful.
And really comforting. Yeah, and really comforting.
Very,
sure.
Very much so. Again, it's. I think it's in time. It's like somebody said there earlier on about, you don't even realise at the time how important. Like, we still talk now about Dad's thing. And again, still little things. You know what I put in with him? A packet of the licorice all sorts. He loved licorice all sorts. And so before, you know, the end, we put I said to one of my daughters, will we put? And they said, yeah. So I ran upstairs and I got a packet of licorice all sorts and I put them in the coffin with them, you know. So, and, you know, silly things. He was very, very fussy, not vain, fussy. And his moustache wasn't trimmed properly. So I said, oh, here, I get a cloth and I put it underneath them. And I said, again, we were kind of laughing. I know that sounds strange. I said, I don't want to knock him off, you know, knock the coffin over. So I had to get up on a chair and I just trimmed his moustache the way he used to do it. And I just said, now, Dad, now you'd be happy. Your moustache is trimmed. You know, I know they all sound, it sounds silly and it, you know, sounds a bit weird maybe to people, but, you know, it was way, it's little things like that.
Doesn't sound weird or silly or anything, Sandra. Sounds really lovely. Will you stay with us? I need to take a break, but I want to talk some more about this after these. Thanks.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Now, I'm learning new things every day. Right now, I know we have a festival on the Irish Wake, and we also have a museum, the Irish Wake Museum. Donica, good afternoon.
Hello, and thank you very much for having me on your show.
I didn't know we had a Wake Museum. What kind of things do we have in our Wake Museum?
Yeah. Down here in Waterford, Waterford City, we have a number of different museums run by Waterford Treasures. And I suppose last year we opened a Wake Museum here as part of our museum offering. So we're looking at the customs and traditions, I suppose, surrounding death, etc., and the whole idea of the wake as well here in Ireland. Mm-hmm. That's what we're looking at here.
So what have you got there?
I suppose what we have is located in a former almshouse. Now, an almshouse, sort of a charity home, really. But it goes, it's quite old. It goes way back to the 1470s. And the building is still here, bang in the city centre of Waterford. It's one of the oldest, I suppose you could say, continuously inhabited buildings in the country. Opened in 1478. Established here to maintain, at the time, 12 old men and women at the end of their lives. Established as a charity by one of the, I suppose, one of the clerics, one of the priests in the cathedral here in Waterford, which would have been just across from it, and established as a charity. So the building is still there, more or less. We did a sort of bit of restoration on it, trying to bring it back to what it would have looked like back in the 1470s. And in it, then, we're sort of exploring, really, I suppose, the traditions here in Ireland surrounding how we do death. You know, which is a different type of experience than we would normally have in the museum sector, really. You know.
And apart from what we were talking about there, the wake and the I love that story that Kevin was telling us about the coffin being put on the chairs in the front of the houses in Mayo.
Absolutely, yeah. And, you know, traditionally now we say, for example, if we go, say, to a funeral home where we have a coffin there, traditionally in Ireland, I suppose, the coffin would be in many houses, which would have been, especially in bedrooms, like, you know, the corpse would have been laid out in the bed. You know, I think that people would have mentioned that again in your programme already. Like, you know, that'd be quite common in some cases. You're talking about perhaps in much smaller houses in the countryside, laid out on the table, the kitchen table. You know, quite a common practice. You know, quite accepted, so that people could be there with the family. Like, you know, and I suppose the wake and the whole idea of the wake again. It was coming out from. I was listening there to some of your contributors. It's a community affair, really. You know, traditional practices going back many, many, many centuries, even thousands of years, of how a community sort of rallies around the family to help them come to terms with this notion of death, you know. So it's always a community affair, a communal affair. And again, then with a series of practices, traditional practices growing up around this.
And there's modern trends as well, of course, now, in terms of it's not all done the old way.
No, sure, things are changing, but I think the essential is still there, you know, very much still there, where, you know, for example, nowadays, you know, in many cases, like the wake would take place perhaps in a funeral home. But I think the essential element of what we do in Ireland is still very much alive, where you would see the community coming to a family and helping them, like, you know. And again, the whole idea of helping out a family, being with them at this time of, you know, this traumatic time, really, even with things like gifts of food and all of this type of stuff, like, you know, all that's still going on.
Still,
like, you know?
Going on, yeah. And of course, people say, you know, you can't give up the wake in the house for the community, for the funeral home. But in many cases, it's a three-step thing, isn't it? There is the wake at home, then there is the removal, the night in the funeral home, and then there is the service, you know, either the mass or the service the following day. You know, so it's all part of the journey now.
It's all part of the journey, and, like, you know, again, like, you know, you see, the tradition and practices they never stay the same. They're always changing and evolving, depending on the situation, you know.
Absolutely.
So I think the essential element is still, you know, central to how we, you know, somebody said, how we do death here in Ireland, quite different from many other countries in the world and even many other European countries.
Indeed, indeed. Thanks for that, Donegan. And talking about, you know, things changing but staying the same. Thanks, Donegan. Brian, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
This is a whole new thing now, actually, and it particularly took off during COVID. This is the live streaming of funerals.
Yeah, that's correct. Live streaming is now a common feature within funerals. But I actually streamed funerals before COVID because people, unfortunately, in America who hadn't green cards couldn't come home maybe to a brother, sister, mother, father's funeral. And I streamed it so they could view it at the time. And that would have been maybe 6-7 years ago I started streaming funerals. But from COVID on, it really took off. And I thought that when the attendances were back to normal in churches that it might end, but it hasn't. Lucky enough for me in that sense that it's still quite common for funerals to be streamed.
And it's not just, people don't just watch them live, do they?
Oh, no. The live event is key to it. And I asked the family if they would send in photographs reflecting the life of the person. And sometimes you get maybe 20, 30 photographs, maybe over 200, so that it's reflecting the life. But then now some families have indicated that for the first anniversary mass or the first anniversary, the families would call up the video and assemble possibly at home or in some area and call up the funeral and watch it again.
The whole family would gather and relive the funeral together. Wow.
Yeah. It's now, because it's available online, all of my recordings are available permanently online, where I know some churches have some cameras, but those aren't necessarily available for any length of time. Some of them are only available during the live stream, but all of my streams are available online indefinitely. So it means that the family can view it and even, as I said, first anniversaries and even some birthdays. The call, they use it as a, you know, whether you go through an album maybe at a wedding anniversaries or that you go through a wedding album. Now they're using the video format as a means of recalling the
recalling and remembering. And of course, with, as you say, so much goes into a funeral now that it's something that it can be preserved and look back at again and revisit it. Brian, thank you for that. I'll take another break.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And can I bring in Dan now? Dan, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Katie.
Now, Dan, this has been so in my mind as I were having this conversation about wakes, because I just saw that They May Face the Rising Sun, that fabulous movie, last night.
Yeah.
And, of course, at the centre of this, we won't say who dies. There's an unexpected death
won't.
In it.
No, we won't. We won't.
But there is a wake in the middle of it. And
sure.
That incredibly moving scene where he's being prepared for the wake.
Sure. Yeah, I must say, I saw when I saw it, it was very poignant, and how the body was being treated in a very respectful way. And there was a lot of time spent in the movie where they showed the preparing of the body, you know, the cleaning of the body, preparing the body. I mean, you could hardly hear a pin drop in the cinema. I was at the Lighthouse, which is a great cinema place in Dublin. You know, even down to the folding of the hands and putting the rosary beads
and do you remember that little exchange about the double? Because Joe, the character played by Barry Ward, wasn't a believer, wasn't familiar,
sure.
and the man he had helping him was able to tell him, "Oh, you do the double, the double over with the
and the crucifix had to be pointing the correct direction,
and the crucifix pointing the right way." Yeah,
and just even the cutting the clothes away and putting on the new clothes, and I suppose, you know, with modern funerals these days, I can remember my own modern father who died at several times and died in hospices. You know, the next time you see them is in the coffin, and they can't be thinking about how the respectful way that bodies are treated and looked after. Somebody had to clothe my father's name after myself, Dan, and my mother, Teresa. So I just thought it was a really, really poignant scene. And I'm from Countrystock myself, where wakes were quite common. The characters in the movie remind me of my dad was in Capamore and my mother was from Maroon, County Limerick. So it brought back, and I really thought it was a fantastic scene. And the director is owed a lot of credit for spending so much time on it.
Oh, it was beautiful. Yeah. And of course, we have that thing there because there's the row about how the body looks. And of course, that's something we never mentioned that already. We all have to comment on how
sure.
how the person who has passed looks and how they've done a great job on them and they look themselves. And that's always part of the funeral chat as well, isn't it? Dan,
sure it was. And the preparing the face and the hair and all that kind of, again, I won't give away the sex of the body, but it was it was just fantastic to see the respect and how they were on a time frame where they needed to prepare the body in a few hours and all that kind of stuff. So I just thought it was a fantastic scene and really, really, I think, caught the audience at that moment where you're thinking about your own maybe family.
Absolutely.
Past, you know?
Absolutely. And Dan, you'll be really interested in the person I have on the other line. I'm delighted to have this caller. Linda, good afternoon.
Hello, how are you doing?
Linda Buckley. Linda, I was watching, as I say, I was at that movie last night, and one of the elements of it, I mean, so beautiful on so many levels, but one of the elements of it that really caught me unawares is the music, because it's there and it's not there and it just brings you through it. And you composed it.
Myself and my sister Irene, that's right. We work a lot together.
Linda, it's so beautiful. Congratulations. And Irene, I got Irene as well?
Yeah, I'm here too.
Irene, congratulations to you both.
Thank
it
you.
Is just
Thank
such
you.
A beautiful piece of work. How did you go about it? Because it must have been a very difficult brief, you know, for it's a movie without any kind of, you know, big plot arc in it. So what were you asked for?
Well, we've worked with Pat Collins a lot before on separate projects over the years, so we sort of know his style very well. And there's a very beautiful, slow, immersive pace to what he does in terms of his imagery and how he brings the viewer through a film. And so we're quite kind of well-versed in his world of filmmaking, I suppose. And so for this, I suppose, we really felt connected to the celebration of rural life in Ireland, something that's really dear to our own hearts growing up on a dairy farm in the old Hedican Sale in Cork. So we felt very connected to it in a lot of ways. And then it's just about something that really adds to the atmosphere or kind of draws the viewer in a way that's not obtrusive either.
I was saying to Louise earlier that if you did grow up in a farm in the 70s or 80s in Ireland, some of it feels like a documentary.
Absolutely. And I love that about Pat Collins' style, is that he's, you know, so famous for his documentary making that aspect comes really through the film as well.
We're hearing it there. Can we play a little touch of the score? Beautiful. It's so beautiful, so atmospheric. It just takes you back into that place. Tell me about that piece of music.
That piece is was written for the scene where there's this summertime and harvest time and working in the fields and just kind of evoking nature and that kind of slow pace and stillness of nature.
That was just a fantastic, just such a beautiful sequence, cutting the hay and the
That's right.
the baler, which we had a baler exactly like that. so it just brought so much back. But it's what kind of a reaction have you got to it?
Amazing.
I mean,
reaction,
we're blown away
getting
really
lots
by
of
it all,
messages,
I think.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. Mm. It's wonderful. We didn't expect such a wonderful reaction.
And when you went to see it first, was it the full piece together, or were you kind of working with scenes as you went along?
We were working with scenes as we went along, but we saw early cuts of the film. But it was really amazing to see the final version in the cinema for the Dublin International Film Festival, and just to be immersed in such a beautiful place with a large screen, and to hear the sound design merging with the music in a way, just felt so special to experience it in that way.
And again, like, were you just kind of given ideas, feelings, you know, a sense of what to do, or, you know, I just wonder how you work with a project like this in particular.
I think the starting point really with Pat was to use the piano, and so we're quite limited in our sound world, but it was nice to focus on one element. And there was a scene in the film where Kate, one of the main characters, plays the piano in the film, but that's not in the final version. So that was a really nice starting point.
I think that what's magic about it, actually, about the score, is how sparse it is in places and then how rich it is in others. Like, it really holds back in moments where you're kind of holding your breath watching it.
That's right.
Connected to Pat. He's very much, he's very careful about his placement and trying to evoke atmosphere, but not trying to overdo things or saturate it or overload it, but really the use of silence and the use of sound design is very important as well. So to know what to leave unsaid and then to actually express in those moments more emotional content, I suppose. Sorry, Irene, I think you were about to jump in there as well.
Yeah, sorry, Irene. And I was going to say, because it leaves a space, because then, of course, the soundscape of the movie is all about the insects and the bird song, and there's so much country sounds there, and the cuckoo coming back. So you had to leave space for that as well.
That's right. And I think in both our music, there's been commented on that it's quite a lot of restraint in our music. Mm-hmm. So I think that's suits Pat's style, because he doesn't really want to give the audience too much. He doesn't want to sort of express too much and let the audience feel things themselves rather than being
completely
told
what to feel. And I must say, that's exactly it, that you don't feel like your buttons are being pushed, that it's just, you're kind of just, it's just left for you there. It's just all laid out there, and you're not being, which is something which is a real bugbear of mine, actually, when you're being kind of, you know, pushed, you're being bullied into basically feeling in a particular way with music or with soundtracks. But this is very, very special.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Will you stay with us? I've got Dom, who I think really enjoyed the movie as well. Dom, good afternoon.
Hi, Katie. How are you?
It stirred a lot of memories for you as well, Dom.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I'm very, very familiar with the location where it was shot, in Inishturas, Cornamona. Our family have probably an 85-year connection to the area, and I've been coming down here all of my life and spent a lot of summers down here. So I'm very familiar with the whole scene, and the house the movie was generally set in was my dad's best friend's house. So it's just evoked so many happy memories for me.
Oh, it was your dad's best friend, that house where Kate and Joe
lives. Yeah, it's incredible. Like, we came down here 2 years ago. We were coming down, myself and my wife were coming down for the bank holiday weekend, and we saw lots of activity. And down here, there wouldn't be a huge amount of activity generally, because it's a very rural area. And then we found out what was happening. They were actually filming the movie. And then when I found out that it was that they may face the rising sun, I was amazed, because I'd read the book as well, and I thought it was just the perfect location.
Absolutely. And of course, if you read the book, and I read the book years and years ago, and it is a gorgeous book, but you would wonder, having read that book, how could you turn that into a movie?
It's the type of book where nothing happens, but everything happens. You know, it's a pure evocation of a life in rural Ireland. And all it's, like I keep on saying, it's complicated simplicity. You know, it just captures everything that goes on in a rural area.
And there is as well that tension between the blow-ins and the locals and the one who left for England, and all those, that, as you say, the complications of life.
Sure. Yeah. The stuff that happens every day.
Okay, I'm told I have to take a break. Dom, stay with us. We'll come back to this after these.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
We're just talking about the movie That They May Face the Rising Sun. If you haven't seen it, go out and see it, is what I'd say to you now, because I saw it last night, and it is a really, really special movie. And I am so delighted that we're talking to Linda and Irene Buckley, who composed the very, very, very beautiful score that is really a huge part of the movie. Linda, can I ask you, would I be familiar with more of your work?
Well, I suppose I would be working within concert music as well as film. And maybe more recently, myself and Irene also did the film Nothing Compares, which was the documentary on Sinéad O'Connor a few years ago, which became quite well known.
Of course, yeah. And how do you work together then as sisters? Is there I'm always interested when I hear siblings managing to actually get over all the sibling stuff and be creative and produce work.
Well, I think one of the first things we did together would have been a live score to the film, the horror film Nosferatu. And after that, we since kind of went on and did other live scores to films like Metropolis. And I think we work very well together because, of course, we know each other so well and our style has similarities to it as well. So I think that it's a very natural way of working where there's so much that is kind of unspoken that we can play sections of our music together, and it just works because we know each other so well, and it's a very instinctive way of working, I think.
And Irene, like, do you do your bit and Linda does her bit and you come together, or do you sit together and work together?
It does vary. Linda is based in Glasgow part of the year, so we can send each other things, and we can also work side by side, and often we might write something separately and we realise that they are quite similar and they can flow into each other, so that is always a nice ending things.
And are you from a big musical family? What's the background there that the two of you got into this at this level?
Yeah, we come from a very musical family. There are 9 kids in the family.
Oh, wow.
And we all learned instruments growing up, maybe 1 or 2 instruments each. So, and 4 of us now are full-time musicians.
And as you say, you grew up on a dairy farm yourselves?
We did, yeah. So it was wonderful to be surrounded by beautiful landscape, and we're surrounded by the sea. So a very inspiring place to live.
And tell me now, with the success of this, and it sounds like, I mean, it's being lauded by critics and by audiences everywhere. Have you hit the red carpet yet for award season? Linda?
We were at the IFTAs a few weeks ago, which was very exciting for us. Really amazing to see everybody there, and just so honoured to be part of it. And we were delighted at the end of the night that the film won Best Film. So that was very, very a great moment.
Oh yeah, and so well deserved, so well deserved.
Thanks.
But so you were all dolled up at the IFTAs.
We were. Great.
Yeah, it was great to meet other members of the film team. So we hadn't met some people, so it was really great to all come together for that.
Yeah, and I suppose when you're so used to collaborating, as you say, with Pat, it must be, you know, very special then to see a movie like this to go this far. And I think it's only at the start of its being lauded. It sounds like it's going to be. I'm told that international audiences are really responding to it really well as well. And I suppose the music must play a big part in that. Irene.
I hope so. Yeah, it's great. It's just so fantastic to get this feedback. We mentioned we saw the premiere at the Dublin Film Festival in the Lighthouse, and it was quite nerve-wracking, you know, to be in such a public place to witness it. But then I went to see it myself then at the cinema just the weekend past, and it was a different experience for me. It was just really, I could feel my heart rate slowing down and seeing a lot more in it. There's a lot of layers in it, so it was great to watch it that way.
I know, yeah, and that was really, again, for such a quiet movie, there was people, I think, barely breathing in the cinema that I was in last night. Just such respect for it, and you know, everyone was in the same space, same headspace. I hoped you could end up in the Oscars, you could be right up there. We could this time next year, you could be picking the Oscars frocks because it does sound like it is getting such a great pickup and a great response all over the place. I believe Bill Whelan has been on to you.
That's right. I mean, it was amazing to see his support. He got in touch recently to say that he loves the score and he's such a supportive person and, you know, such a great influence on us as well. So it's lovely to hear from him.
Who would you look to, like, in terms of composers and scores? As you know, like, I'm thinking John Williams, obviously, is the big one. What would be your, if you had to pick the score that you wish you had written?
I mean, we were both very interested in film scores growing up, and I suppose ones that stand out for me would be Wojciech Kilar's score to Dracula and Danny Elfman's score to Edward Scissorhands, which we loved both growing up as well.
Oh, you obviously liked the darker side.
I think so, a little bit. Them kind of magical as well. Yeah,
yeah, absolutely. And I was reminded as well that Philip Dolan spoke to Joe on this programme not so long ago, and I could not believe watching him on screen last night that was his first outing, basically. It's an incredible performance. Incredible performances from everyone, I'm sure you'll agree. It is, it's just as, I can't think of a bad thing to say about it. It's just such a lovely movie. Okay, I'm told I have to take another break. Yeah, I have to take another break. Thank you for
that. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy!
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And we're talking about the lovely, lovely, lovely movie That They May Face the Rising Sun. Paul Kendrick, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Katie.
Your brother was working on the movie.
He was, and he's going to kill me for this. Richard Kendrick was the director of photography who was very much involved in this film. Now, how the family found out that he was up for an award, both Cinematographic Award and also Best Film Award, was through Facebook. So he doesn't actually sing his praises a lot, but I'm going to do it on the radio now.
Oh, you must be so proud of him. What an extraordinary job he did on this movie.
Extraordinary, yes. And I think I talked to him. I went to see it with family there last week, and That They May Face the Rising Sun, the John McGahern book. It was a marvellous composition of everyone playing their part. That's down to the music by Linda and Irene there, I believe, who they only met, my brother, on the night of the award ceremony. And I believe this film has won two awards for the best Irish film. It's the Dublin International Film Festival was the first one a month or so ago. And then the IFTA.
The IFTA, yeah.
IFTA.
I would say the first of many, Paul, because honestly, it's so gorgeous on so many levels.
It is stunning. Now I know my brother, and was very complimentary of Pat Collins, who drove the whole thing, and I believe he's a fantastic director to work with, and I know a lot of praise must go to him, apart from all the rest of the crew. But the scenery is absolutely stunning. I couldn't believe we could find a place like that in Ireland.
And I couldn't believe we found the weather like that.
And the weather.
Because I was saying it was reminiscent of those childhood memories you have where it was always sunny. And that's the sense you got from it. It's just drenched in sunshine and nostalgia.
Yeah, and also it showed the four seasons, which my brother was talking to me about, because I had to come back and do a winter scene, especially because obviously they were doing it in the summer. But the film brings you through the four seasons, and even the bird singing is phenomenal in the background. It is unbelievable. Even the opening scene with the sunset, you may remember the sunset at both at the start of the film and at the end of the film.
Yeah,
with the cloud and the sunshine, and that was just by pure chance, he says, happened to be in the right place at the right time, and it just set the scene for the film. And as it was, it portrays Ireland as it was, I think, back in the 20s, 30s, with the relatives returning and the wake, which was done so professionally. It was marvellous to see the band and the wedding scenario. It was magical. So acting was superb.
That's it there. And that's the score again. Linda and Irene, yeah. Buckley's beautiful, beautiful score. That's it. I'm out of time, Paul. Congratulations to Richard and for his extraordinary work on the cinematography, director of photography on that movie. Thanks for that, Paul. On sound today was Mark McGrath. Research was Richie Byrne. Our broadcast coordinator was Shane Galvin. And today's program was produced by Annette Egan. Stand by for Ray.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Elevate your bedroom with our fresh new bedding designs and colours, in-store and online at harrycurry.com.
0818 715 815 stays open until 3:15 p.m. or email joe at rte.ie.